You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Good afternoon. I hope you guys have been enjoying the sessions. It sounds like there's a lot of good, robust conversation, which I'm pretty excited about. It is my honor to introduce to you our next keynote speaker, Dr. Nava Ashraf. Nava Ashraf is a professor of economics at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where she is also the co-director of the Psychology and Economics Program at Stickard, and the founder and director of the Altruistic Capital Lab. Her work has been published in the American Economic Review, the Journal of Political Economy, Econometrica, and the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization, among many other academic outlets. Ashraf's research combines psychology and economics using both lab and field experiments to test insights from behavioral economics in the context of global development, particularly digging into health and educational services. She also explores intra-household decision-making and gender norms in the areas of finance, fertility, and labor force participation. Her work examines thorny questions like the role of trust and power dynamics in institutions, how flourishing takes place, and the importance of imagination and creativity in human flourishing. It's a pleasure to have you here. Please come join us, Dr. Ashraf.
Great. Thank you, Stephanie, for that warm introduction. I'm so happy to be with all of you and to be able to present. Can you hear me? Okay. It's a delight to present our work on trust in the market and its application to female entrepreneurship, which is joint with Alexia Delfino and Ed Glaser. This isn't an audience that I need to tell that economists have long thought trust is incredibly important in economic interaction. Here's a quote from Ken Arrow, that virtually every commercial transaction has within itself an element of trust. Certainly any transaction conducted over a period of time. It can be plausibly argued that much of the economic backwardness in the world can be explained by the lack of mutual confidence. That's a big claim. Is it true? A growing large literature suggests that it is indeed, that trust, in fact, contributes to growth and development significantly, that it explains a sizable fraction of the variation of regional GDP around the world. And earlier work helps us understand why, that trust reduces transaction costs and contributes to the efficiency of economic organizations. This might be particularly the case in industries and areas where economic transactions take the form of repeated long-term trade and partnerships and collaboration. And this is where we're getting to what I'm interested in talking about today. So in particular, think about manufacturing, where economies of scale can generate very large returns to collaboration and partnership. The problem is that collaboration and partnership, despite the great economic gains it might bring, requires a level of trust because it can be risky. You are vulnerable to the fear of expropriation from one party to the other. And so, without trust or institutions, firms, for example, in developing countries, remain small and economies can't grow. Just one example of this negative feedback loop between low trust and low economic development. And that actually, when we look around the world, take this sort of standard world values survey question on generalized trust, can you trust others? It is indeed much lower in developing countries or the so-called global south. And actually, if you look between men and women It's even lower among women and lower among women in developing countries. So why is that? Let's take the example of the Global South. So why would that be lower? Now, I'm going to just give you one contributing factor, probably much at work and it's going in both directions, but one contributing factor is the rise of very rapid urbanization, which happened in the last several decades, of course, everywhere in the world. I'm going to be looking in particular in Africa and then in particular in Zambia, where I have been working for the last 16 years and have a field site. The rate of rapid urbanization has meant that people have left villages where they had extremely intimate networks of trust into cities of anonymity without the corresponding rapid development of institutions that could make the great part of being in cities in that kind of density of networks useful for people, and instead created a situation of low trust. And so that's the hard part, is that cities lose much of their advantage. This beautiful density that we get in cities can lose much of their advantage if individuals cannot safely trade. And then if we look within that, that dynamic of fear of expropriation that can happen without institutions or the kind of informal networks that created trust to be able to help facilitate that, that dynamic is even more exacerbated when there are power differentials between partners. And so if you think about any asymmetries of power or, for example, physical strength, that can enhance the risks of expropriation. So we look in particular with women and men, and men can have higher bargaining power due to the shadow threat of violence and or a higher social standing. So in fact, actually all over the world, you see that sexual harassment is higher in male-dominated jobs and sectors, and there's weaker economic punishment for male perpetrators. That's just some evidence that you can have a situation where men may have greater bargaining power, and that may then create a corresponding situation where there's a fear of expropriation. And that's the challenging part, is that trust is hard to build with these kinds of asymmetries of power between economic partners. And if you don't have corresponding institutions and rule of law to help create that trust, then that means that this type of, for example, intergender collaboration, which could create great economic gains, won't happen. And that's at a loss of economic efficiency. So just to give you one example, I mean, there's two things that I think trust does in this space of economic partnership. The first is that it determines the feasible contracting space, right? So, and we'll talk about this in just a second, that actually where you can get towards the frontier is determined by the trust you have between partners. Trust and or institutions can actually decide on the second front which of the contracts is actually enforceable and enforced. So to give you an example of how this might work, imagine just two partners that are wanting to get together for trade or collaboration, and you've got an efficient frontier. And in order to get to the efficient frontier, each partner has to in some way reveal to the other what is low cost for them and high value, and similarly with the other. Otherwise, you can't find the joint gains, right? And this is what I spent many years teaching MBA's negotiation at HBS, and this is what we call the negotiator's dilemma. That actually, it's in order to get to the efficient frontier, you need to risk the possibility of revealing something that is then going to make you vulnerable to expropriation. And so what you then might do is, for example, just not get to the frontier, because you really can't afford to risk, because whatever you reveal in terms of, for example, what's low cost to you, that may determine where you are on the frontier. That will determine the distribution of resources, not just how you get to the frontier. And in order for you not to do that, you'll actually not reveal everything, and then you'll only get partway to the frontier. That's a loss for everyone. Or even if you get to the frontier, if you have any fear that that contract may not be enforced, even if you don't have the large bargaining power but you get to the frontier, the fact that that contract is not enforceable in your environment means that the actual proportion you get out of that contract is even less. And so we study this within the context of female entrepreneurship to be able to understand a few of the puzzles that we've seen around the world in the data, but in particular, really embedding ourselves in the environment of Zambia and female entrepreneurs in Africa. But I hope that we can talk more broadly about how this impacts many occasions for partnership and collaboration. And in this paper, we kind of put forward the hypothesis that women may fear expropriation in male-dominated sectors and therefore self-segregate economically, which is what we see when we look at the data. And we provide a framework to think about how the need for cooperation in production creates the scope for both bargaining and expropriation, and that could disproportionately harm the least powerful partner, in this case, women. And then I'll provide you some evidence on gender gaps in entrepreneurship and the role of institutions around the world. This is going to be mainly correlational. And then we'll dive deep within Zambia and be able to provide some experimental variation where exogenously we're able to improve the quality of institutions and enforceability to see what the effects might be on collaboration and trust. Okay, so to give you why we study female entrepreneurship in more general terms, why this application? So worldwide, we know that entrepreneurship is male-dominated. Only 1 in 3 entrepreneurs are women. And not only is entering into entrepreneurship male-dominated, so are its most profitable sectors. So in Africa, for example, women entrepreneurs self-select into low-profit industries such as food services, retail, cosmetic salons. And firms in female-dominated industries, this is a global review, are on average 56% smaller than those in male-dominated industries. So in this global review, you can see, and this is in DRC, you can see that the choice of industry explains a quarter of the gender gaps in profits, which is, again, one of these puzzles, like why, even when you give credit to women, are they not able to grow as much or have the same level of profits as male firms? We look within manufacturing, where there's really important economies of scale. And in that sector, the choice of industry explains almost all the gender gap in industries. So why such segregation in occupational choice? There have been more broadly lots of reasons given. For example, specialized talent. Maybe women learn early on how to make good food or how to be in the service industry, and therefore they're more likely to be able to be good at that. Access to particular forms of training and capital or lack of access thereof to get into certain industries. Or, for example, that women just prefer to be in those industries, partly because maybe it helps them to have flexible time with their children or be in an area in an informal setting that would allow that. In this paper, we add another reason which has not been brought out before, which is that women prefer either to not enter entrepreneurship or to work in female-dominated industries where they would have both female collaborators and customers for fear of expropriation in male-dominated industries. Now, what's not in the paper, but I can share with you all, because I know that people here are coming from a broad variety of backgrounds, and there's a great appreciation for qualitative work, is that this hypothesis came out of an extensive period of time of informal qualitative work with focus groups and interviews with female entrepreneurs in Zambia. And they are the ones who told us that this was really at work in their decision making. And so this is why we wanted to actually test to what extent this might be determining the gender gaps in profits that we see, the segregation in industrial choice, et cetera. So just to give you a little bit of motivation before I give you the framework, just looking broadly internationally and thinking, this is from the World Justice Project, the enforcing contract score everywhere in the world, on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is female-owned businesses. This is just what in which countries do women tend to enter entrepreneurship more and become bosses? And you can see that it's quite low everywhere, but there's a huge amount of variation around the world, right? So this is just one reason why what might be driving that variation, just correlational. We'll get more causal soon. But just as way of motivation, you can see that there's a very strong positive correlation with the ability to enforce contracts. And so let me turn to our framework to give you a reason why that might be the case. And it's a very simple setup. Think about 4 stages. And we take a female entrepreneur, and we're going to really use our case studies from our calls ahead of work. That there's a female entrepreneur, imagine a tailor where many women and men enter entrepreneurship, receives an opportunity to produce a product. So actually she gets a very large order of school uniforms. But in order to actually meet the demands of the client, she has to recruit a partner. And that is randomly drawn. So think of, you know, being in a market and needing to get someone who just has the capacity to do it as soon as possible because you have to meet this order. And if they partner now, they agree on a share, S, of the product value for P. And there's no renegotiation at this stage. So that's the first stage, is just the decision of what share they will get. And then in the second stage, the partner decides whether to work or shirk. In the third stage, the female entrepreneur learns whether the partner's breached or fulfilled the agreement. And then at the fourth stage, either the partner or the entrepreneur can take the other to an adjudicator, so a court, a local ruler, et cetera. And this is an adaptation, extension of Burr et al. Okay, so if you take those four stages, there's two stages in which the power disadvantage, or the female disadvantage here, come really to the fore. The first is the first stage, right? So if the other partner, and in this case the man, has more bargaining power, he receives a greater share of the surplus. And that we can assume in this model coming from norms about gender or the threat of violence. But the norms, if the norms are such that he will almost certainly get more of the surplus, we can assume that. And then we sort of assume that if you instead decide to partner with a woman, you're going to get a 50-50 share of the surplus. But the other stage in which there could be a disadvantage for women is at the fourth stage of enforcement, where institutional bias could cause the problem. And that's not the case if the facts are perfectly clear and the contract is perfectly clear. But when facts are disputable, and this is based on other evidence, adjudicators can favor men. And so if, for example, the partner's shirking is disputable with some probability, when institutions, the way we model it is that when institutions are stronger, a wider range of facts are indisputable. But, and so, and institutions always rule fairly if facts are indisputable. But if they're at all disputable, then local bias can enter institutions. And that can create another source of disadvantage. And so obviously, a central point of the model is that institutions operate amidst deeper and more permanent societal features. And while we, you know, wrote this framework to try to make sense of what we were seeing on the field and be able to motivate the analysis that we do afterwards on female entrepreneurship, once we thought about it, we realized it well applies to any environment in which you're having partnerships or collaboration, for example, in economic research, where, you know, women may self-segregate into industries or fields with more women, and they tend to single author. So I'm just going to put that out there provocatively a little bit, just to sort of think about how much you could think about where this model would fit in other environments. But to go back to our picture of, you know, getting to the efficient frontier, here's where the disadvantage can really hurt kind of everyone. So, you know, imagine that a woman, if by herself, she would get some portion. If she kind of did this by herself, maybe she can't take on the bigger things, but she can kind of at least know that she's going to get all of the pie for herself. Now she decides to negotiate, and she's not going to be able to get a large proportion. Maybe there's like 30% of the pie that she'd be able to negotiate for herself. But if, to the extent that the contract is enforceable, she'll at least know that that's 30%. But the problem is that first, that may not be worth it in the end to engage in. And secondly, even if she's able to negotiate a higher proportion, if the contract is not enforceable because of low strength of institutions, then that actually, as a proportion of what she's expected to get, she may then not want to enter that collaboration. That means that both parties may lose out from the potential that there is there. And so that starts to give you the sense of what we're, and you know, this is here, this is the trust game, which you all are familiar with. We're going to run this with entrepreneurs in 80 markets in Lusaka. And then at the very end, I'm also going to share with you trust games that we did with girls and their parents that they were negotiating with. So in a very different setting to think about bargaining power and enforcement of norms. Okay, so the prediction is that there would be an incentive for women to partner with other women in order to avoid expropriation, and that women would concentrate into industries that allow cooperation with each other. And that what we see in terms of gender gaps in earnings and partnerships are mitigated in places with lower bargaining power for men and stronger institutions, or stronger institutions in both. So just as a kind of first take, we take this to the cross-country data, and you can see that if you look, so the y-axis now is enforcing contracts, and the x-axis is discrimination in the family, so basically a measure of gender norms. And what you see is that in places where discrimination and gender norms are very strong, you get about 30% female entrepreneurship. In places where gender norms are very biased against women, however, there are strong contract enforcement, you get an increase in the amount of female entrepreneurship. But correspondingly, where enforcing contracts is low, but discrimination is also low, you can get an increase. And then the best is sort of if you have both. Okay, so this is just kind of amusing to be able to look across countries and be able to see these patterns. Now we're going to really turn to trying to see this within micro data and see what we find. So we're going to look in Zambia, where there's a high level of gender discrimination. So in the World Value Survey, 68% of respondents said that it's justifiable for men to beat their wives in some circumstances. Justice is biased against women, so it has one of the lowest scores in the World Justice Project's overall index of gender equality in sub-Saharan Africa. And it has low trust, so it's one of the lowest in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in growing urban areas. And we're going to be looking particularly in Lusaka, which is actually sub-Saharan Africa's fastest growing city. So it's not a surprise that trust is low. And what we do is actually a somewhat ambitious idea we had, because we really wanted to see where are all the firms everywhere. And that's what you're going to see here is actually our geocode of every single firm that we could find. So we did a census of all the entrepreneurs in all of Lusaka, which is 48,000 businesses in total. And we got the industry and size for them. And like any typical city in sub-Saharan Africa, most firms are in retailing, and 98% have less than 20 employees. And then we did a kind of shorter survey with manufacturing firms, because we thought if you're going to, you know, see the gains from partnership anywhere, it would be in manufacturing. Those would be firms with less than 20 employees, about a 60% response rate. And in that, we were able to get the owner's gender and other demographics, sales and business history, to look at trust, both generalized as well as in neighbors and in strangers. And then cooperation. So actually, I wanted to be able to really clarify, what do we mean by collaboration or cooperation in a free market situation? So this is things like sharing an order. So produce like the example I gave you in the theoretical framework that we had, partnering in order to produce an order from a client. Joint buying, making joint orders of materials from suppliers so that you can get a lower price if you go in together. Lending, borrowing. This is actually really important in manufacturing, because you need machines and it's very hard. So you want to be able to take a piece of somebody's machine for a while, but you need a little bit of trust to be able to give people their machine. Material, other assets, and advice. So asking advice from other firms. These are really activities that allow firms to overcome scale constraints, because there's this really big puzzle also about why firms in developing countries don't grow. And you could either try to grow within a firm or try to have these sort of clusters. And when we would talk to individuals, they would say, well, you know, I trust my family, but that only goes so far in terms of the amount of growth. So these are really activities that have very high economic returns, but really require trust to be able to engage in. And here's what we find in terms of the gender gaps. So 75% of women work in apparel, 18% work in food manufacturing. So all of these are in the manufacturing sector. So they are concentrating in the least profitable sectors in manufacturing. Women have lower sales than men. So for example, like in a good week, that's $226 for men versus $130 for women. And they are much smaller than men's. So men have, on average, 1.052 employees, and women have 0.68. So this is, you know, in a world in which most people are in some form of, this is self-employment, and they're usually one-person firms, it's really great if you can get to five people and get to more. The other things that are kind of interesting and were surprising to us is that the two genders learn their trade differently. So 75% of men learn their trade from other entrepreneurs or from family versus 40% of women. So women tend to learn their trade more from going to courses, for example, than from other people. And as we might have expected, women trust others less than men. So on the question of can most people be trusted, that's 10% of men versus 4% of women. And that is evidence, that evidence in Zambia is aligned with work that many others have found in many countries otherwise. We also find that this kind of cooperation measured by joint buying, lending, advice, sharing orders is much lower among women than men. And so we also average that. We find that it is much lower. Importantly, actually, this kind of cooperation, this was also a nice, for those of you who do trust games, we're, you know, it's wonderful to know that the World Value Survey measure is correlated with how people play the game. And in here, it was kind of edifying to learn that the cooperation measures are highly correlated with how people answer the World Value Survey question on trust. It's also highly correlated with sales, which is not surprising. So again, this is just one example of the many kind of interviews and focus groups that give us some sense of what's going on in this sort of background of this mechanism. So this is, for example, a female tailor located just outside of City Market. And this, the date tells you how long we've been doing this. I had some big contracts for hotel uniforms in the past, around 50 to 100 pieces. I was working with some man. I was going back in the morning to check his work, and he would always be at the same point. That's because men start doing their own jobs when you're not there. Men steal and run away. They drink a lot. It's a challenge with men. I don't like working with them. This doesn't mean all men. It doesn't mean, but it just is kind of the risk of undertaking this, given people's experiences, has been so high that it's hard then to engage in it, even though you could have these strong economic returns. So then we ask, like, what can we do about it? Because that just seems like a tragic ending for everyone. And so we ask what institutions could actually help. And we look at three institutions that are in the local environment. The first is market chiefs, the second is small claims courts, and the third is police. And here's the map of all of the firms in Lusaka, and where everything is based. So you can see that, so we look at 80 markets within the city of Lusaka, and each of them have a market chief. The market chiefs are, they can be either elected or appointed, but they're meant for dispute resolution among the marketeers. That's their role. And you can see that they're in every market. The police stations are pretty widespread. The small claims court is right there in the middle. It was actually meant precisely for people who have very small needs that where they might worry that someone ran away with their money or didn't do their work or whatever. But as you'll see, you know, it turned out when we did our first analysis that only 10% of people had heard about the small claims court, even though it had been there for many years. And then later we went back and we learned that they actually don't trust the small claims court. They thought it was the same as this other court that they had been engaged with. And so now, as I'll share with you at the very end, we're doing some work on that front. But before we did that, when we heard that most people hadn't heard about the small claims court, we just decided to focus on the market chiefs and see what role do the market chiefs have in helping to engender trust in these kinds of collaborations, and can they actually be, kind of, can this institution be something that can help? It's locally developed, locally understood in this frontier. So just to give you a sense, 59%, this is like a standard market. Anyone who's been to a city in Africa is familiar with this. And 59% of manufacturers are located in formal markets. There's about 83 markets, and 30% of all businesses are in markets. So in order to get into the market, you have to apply to be part of the market. And each market is led by a market chief that's appointed or elected, and they legislate, they have market unit guidelines, and they're involved in dispute resolution. So some of the dispute resolutions are like, someone brought another marketeer's machine but didn't pay, and the chief was able to order to pay in 3 weeks. Actually, I remember one time we went to one chief's office, and they had like a hairdresser's blow dryer, and they had assets from various different marketeers who hadn't paid their dues or had not had shirked on a partnership. And so they have this kind of ability to enforce that's kind of mutually agreed on. They're well known and commonly used. So we asked people actually, think about, because we wanted to see among the various institutions that are locally available, how do people perceive them? Think about an average marketeer in this market. Another person in the market buys item on credit and doesn't pay back. Which person or group would the person owed money most likely go to? And you know, for both men and women, it is invariably the market chief. Very few people go to the police, and even fewer go to the court. As I shared with you, very few had even heard of the court. And that's any court at all. Note also, this is interesting, even though very few had occurred at the court, women tend to go to the court more regularly. Okay, think about it then, and the market chiefs have the highest reputation. How often do you think that, and it was hard to sort of ask about bias as much, although we do that too. So we ask if you think the process would be fair or slow. And you know, most people are much more likely to think that the market chief would be fair than the police, and less likely to think that they would be slow than the police or the court. Actually, the court they think would be very, very slow, which then, as I was mentioning, the small claims court is really, really fast, but the local court, which is what had been there before, was very, very, very slow. So that accounts for why people are putting their previous experiences into that. And that is, you know, all of these are especially the case among women, as you could see from some of the differences. You go to the chairman and you take it from there. You do not go to the police. They are helpful. Women would be better at convincing the chairman. Market chiefs listen more to women, even male chiefs. So then we ask the question, does the protection provided by the market chief benefit women? And what we do as the first take is just to compare the outcomes of entrepreneurs who are located within a market with their counterparts who are located just outside the market. So we take just the boundary of the market and we control for density of the with marketplace fixed effects and controls for population density and granular measures of business density. And we find that female owners located into a market cooperate just as much as men do inside the market and more than women do outside the market. And they have relatively higher sales than men. So that shows you just that the suggestion that this local institution could overcome these gender gaps and that they're not fundamental to what women and men are. And then we try to really see, like, how much does this vary by the gender bias of the chief? Because, you know, if our hypothesis is right, this should only happen in markets where the chief is not biased. And so we do a survey. It was during COVID, so we did a phone survey of all the chiefs. And we look at chief gender bias, chief competence as a dispute adjudicator, and chief competence as a manager. Let me see if we have the gender bias. We don't have the exact, but what we do is scenarios. So we give them various scenarios, putting different people's names in, being able to measure the gender bias. And you see that, you know, you saw this clearly, that women cooperate more in markets in general, but not when the chief is gender biased. So that is even further kind of suggestion that actually this is really about an unbiased institution helping you to make these economic transactions happen. And they cooperate just like men do in markets, as we saw, but not when the chief is gender biased. Okay, so that was just, you know, I'm showing you correlations to some degree, controlling for as much as I can, but being someone who tries to do as many causal experiments as possible, we want to get beyond the observational evidence. Just see what could we get causally on this. Obviously, it's hard to just look at people who are within the market versus not, because they could be very different on multiple dimensions. And so what we do is we embed a lab in the field experiment to show the causal effect of access to local rulers on both trust and business cooperation. This is just a modified version of the trust and investment game. So I'm sure that this audience knows well the investment game. So here we, and we frame it really like an investment game so that it's a business opportunity. We actually say to them, we have a business opportunity. The way we do this is that, like I said, there's 80 markets, right? So we have our enumerators go up to player A and say, hey, there's a business opportunity. I have my colleague is in another market with another person, or in your market with another person. I'll show you the differences. And you get an endowment of 10 tokens. You can invest. This player B, this trustee, has a business opportunity for you to invest in. You can tell me how much you want to invest in it, and I will tell my colleague who will tell that person. And that person then has a decision. It's going to get tripled because it's a business opportunity. It will grow. And that person can decide how much to send back. And my colleague will ask that person. They will get triple whatever you sent them, and they can decide whatever to send back. How much would you like to send them? And the important part was that we could do this in real time as well, and in a way that was salient to people, because there's a person right in front of them, they know that there's someone else who's going to be getting the money, and then it's coming back. And it was very realistic to them, this idea that there's a business opportunity, the money that they invest could grow, and that the other person could then send back. The risk was also very salient to them, that the person may not send anything back. The one thing that we vary, really importantly, is institutional access. So we thought about how do we want to do this, and we wanted to use the local institution that people were used to. So we said, what we're going to do is, even though these are in markets, right, so you still have access to the market chief, but we made it even easier for people. So it varied in the trust game whether the investor can appeal to a local institution if he or she thinks that the amount sent back by the trustee is not fair. And whatever that is for you, so we sort of said that. And that would give us the causal impact of institutions on business-related trust. And we tried to do that in a way that was as unbiased as possible. And let me share with you how we kind of tried to work out the details to make sure that that was the case. So I'm not going to share with you the small claims court thing, because I'll tell you at that end. So about 480 entrepreneurs, 16 marketplaces located inside and within 500 meters of the market. The randomization was within markets, and it was stratified by gender and business location. Crucially here, it was anonymous play. So the gender was unknown to both sides. And there was two rounds for each player switching roles and partners, and they know that they'll play once with each partner. And this was the complaint practice. We designed it such that it was very common, like the way that people, we asked people, how would you usually go and complain to the chief? So what we said is, if you think that the number of tokens sent back by player B is not fair, you can ask us to call the chief on your behalf to decide how many tokens each of you should get. The chief's ruling is based only on your choices and the choices of player B, and we will tell you their decision accordingly. The chief doesn't know anything about you and the other player, only your choices. The reason we did that is we wanted to anonymize, because as you saw, there is variation in gender bias among the chiefs, and we wanted to be able to do this in all the markets. So this was our way of basically de-biasing all the other chiefs that may not, if they had known who this was or that it was a woman, they may have been more biased or less biased. So we wanted to just basically see what happens when you kind of de-bias the institution fully. And we go to the chiefs. Each chief we made a collaboration with. We said, we're doing this study, and we actually would bring them the complaints, and they would get the rulings, and we would get the rulings in real time. So obviously, it's different from real-life disputes because we're able to guarantee the unbiasedness of the institutions through anonymity. But it gives you a sense of, if you have kind of unbiased institutions, what's the extent to which you could increase trust? Yeah, and as I said, like half of the participants think that the chief is rarely or never fair. So there's very, like, a lot of variation in that. And interestingly, there's a very strong prediction on trust when there's the debiasing that happens, and I'll share that with you. So the outcome variable here is the number of tokens that is sent by the investor to the trustee. And this, in a sense, like in the diagram I showed you of getting to the efficient frontier, as you well know, like the efficient frontier, if you had full trust, is sending all 10 tokens, right? Because that gives 30 for the whole pie. And ideally, you would, you know, trust the other person to give you 15, and you end up with 5 more than you started with. That's full trust. If you have zero trust, you would send nothing. Okay, and usually what we find in trust games is something in the middle. But here, the thing is, if how much the trust store sends is going to determine how close you get to the efficient frontier. And so you can't have a pie unless the trust store decides to send. And what we find in control, where you don't have access to an unbiased chief, women indeed send much less than men do. So they send about, you know, 30% compared to men who send above 40%. And that actually reveals to us, given, you know, everything we've seen on how women, both in their own stories as well as how they answer the trust questions and the cooperation questions, that people bring their past experiences to bear in playing this game. It's yet another example of how playing these lab in the field experiments can really help us understand people's experiences in a more aggregate way. Now, if we add the chief, that changes. And actually, there's no significant difference between women and men. In fact, just looks like just a little bit more. Actually, women give even a little bit more than men. But in general, you've got this you know, big push up of women sending more. Of course, what that does, because it gets tripled, is that the whole pie for everyone is a lot bigger. This increase that I just showed you is much larger in chief in markets that had started with worse chiefs. So those markets where we knew that those chiefs were biased and unfair, those are the ones where when we unbiased the chief through this experimental manipulation, women gave even more. And that difference between men and women just, you know, was very large in control and really got completely fixed in treatment. And it's also larger in the chiefs. This is the results for if the chief is not usually or always slow, or if he's fair in general. Okay, so not about gender bias overall, but in general, you can see that, you know, in control, it's a significant difference. But in the gender bias, it's even larger. And, you know, the difference becomes a lot in the biased examples. So this is just female investors and how they behave in the two kinds of markets. So what we learn is that access to the chief's ruling, in particular to an unbiased chief's ruling, significantly decreases extremely low return ratios. So what I want to stress is we already saw that it helps women give more. Now, what's going on? We look at what is happening on the trustee side. And what we see is that if you look at the distribution of trustees sending back, the ones that are sending back very, very, very little, they're just gone once you have an unbiased chief. So people don't dare to send back just a tiny, tiny amount anymore. And that left tail is gone. So we think what that does is reduce the risk involved of being, you know, there's some really nice work by Zeckhauser and Bonnet and Zeckhauser, which is about betrayal aversion and these very low return ratios that happen at the lower end of the tail. So reducing the risk involved with making women. And women are indeed willing to pay for chief's protection, because we actually ask about their willingness to pay as well. There's an increase of the investor's earnings, so women actually benefit tremendously from this as a result of the higher trust that they're able to put in. And there's an increase, obviously, in efficiency, so we get stronger to the frontier, closer to the frontier, when women's trust is determining the overall size of the pie. So then we ask whether other institutions can help. And this is just work in progress. I've just spent a bunch of time in the field trying to understand this. So as I mentioned, this is market chiefs. They're biased and unbiased. We tried to sort of experimentally make them unbiased. But the big elephant in the room is that actually The Zambian government and the Ministry of Justice had created the Small Claims Court precisely for the most vulnerable, the ones who have the least money, to be able to have access to justice. And I think you all know the quote from Adam Smith about when justice is gone, all the atoms of society just, you know, fall on the ground. So obviously, having access to just institutions would be wonderful. Why is it that people don't know about them, or if they know about them, they think they're so biased? And a lot of that is because from our qualitative work, there was also within urban areas something that was created called local courts. And local courts are traditional justice. They were based as much on traditional justice that were in villages where the village chiefs were distributing justice. That, of course, then varies a lot depending on the bias of the chiefs. In the local courts, there were a lot of stories of potential for bias, but also just it's a public trial, and that then made women very uncomfortable about going there and providing that. You need sometimes a lawyer. It can take a really long time. There's a lot of uncertainty about how much it costs. All of those were taken out of the small claims court. So the small claims court is very, very cheap to start. You don't need a lawyer. You can speak in your local language. And so what we're wanting to do is to randomize, and we're just in trials for this, to randomize the dissemination of information and investigate how it changes the preferences for business collaborators. But of course, just randomizing information about the small claims court, given what I've just told you about people's priors, is not going to be sufficient. So what we did was actually create videos of people who are from these areas, who are from, for example, low socioeconomic status, women, et cetera, going to the small claims court, and conversations with the clerk at the small claims court about what's really involved in terms of money, for example, and at each stage. So really creating the full transparency. And I also made sure that every surveyor who was going to give this information themselves had gone to the small claims court and actually had their own experience so that they could truthfully say, I've gone there, and actually you don't need to bring a lawyer. You don't need to have this much money. This is how much it costs. You can, so basically, essentially creating that trust in the institution. And we did this in collaboration with the Ministry of Justice. So I have a model that I have tried to implement for the last 16 years in Zambia, where we try to co-generate knowledge together with people on the ground. And that's because of this idea that, you know, knowledge that's generated, I'm just going to take a little moment to talk about it given this audience, because we sort of tend to think about academic knowledge as being, scientific knowledge as being generated only by academics, and then wonder why it's not making its way into practice. The awful thing is that, you know, practitioners and policymakers are generating their own knowledge. Their knowledge also doesn't make its way back into science. So we have knowledge gaps in society all over the place. And I tried for the first 10 years of my career to train people to do as much of that dissemination process as possible, but it didn't work. And what I realized is that actually we can't do it like that. We have to actually get off of our pedestals, understand that knowledge is generated everywhere, and nobody has monopoly on knowledge, and that we actually come up with the questions together, we look at the data together, and we look at the results at every stage together. And that's what we've done now with the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Education in numerous projects, and we're doing now with the Ministry of Justice. It is based on a lot of like Hayek's views also on the decentralization of knowledge. And so in this partnership, we're also going to run a real business collaboration where tailors are going to be asked to make a tote bag and then to work together and discern whether an intergender collaboration increases with access to information on the small claims court. Okay, so that's on contract enforcement and the role of institutions. As you saw, that's only one aspect of the possibility of disadvantage when people have less power. The other aspect is that first stage of coming up with a contract and the level of bargaining power to design the contract. And so that in that stage, we were thinking about the way in which negotiation skills could potentially ameliorate this issue of being able to find the joint gains, but not at the cost of actually being able to have an improved situation for yourself. And in fact, many years ago, so this started in, I think, 2013 or 14, in collaboration with the Ministry of Education, who wanted to understand why there was so much dropout in grade 7 and grade 8 of young girls in Zambia, we adapted a curriculum to be able to teach negotiation skills to all the grade 8 girls in Lusaka over a period of time. And this was, as I mentioned, this was the time when I was teaching negotiation skills to MBAs, and I was also working in the field in Zambia, and I thought, my gosh, like, here we've got the people who are using it for commercial transactions. That's wonderful, but would it be, what would it mean for people who have basically the least power? I can't really imagine less power than a 12-year-old girl in Zambia in all of her interactions. What would happen if she had access to these skills? But the process of adaptation was really very intense. And so we were really lucky to work together with a whole group of teachers as part of the Anti-AIDS Teachers Association of Zambia, because part of what we were looking at was, you know, the process of delaying first sexual encounter, being able to negotiate with your boyfriend, as well as eventually with your parents for schools. And we found 20 extraordinary young women who were from the same compounds in Lusaka, had faced all the same constraints, but had somehow managed to come out of them and go to university. And we worked with them over 2 years to adapt this curriculum to be able to teach negotiation skills in a setting in which just raising your voice and asking questions is very problematic. So, you know, it also took a long time to get human subjects review for this because they were concerned that we would create a cadre of unruly girls. And it really made me think about, what do we understand when we think about empowerment and let's empower people? The cost for them of overcoming the social constraints is so high. So the challenge before us was, how could we teach the ability to ask for what you want in a way that enhances the social fabric, not destroys it? So that it could be in line with the Zambian values on family unity and the importance of community. And so that is what ended up becoming the Girls Arise curriculum that is very focused on achieving joint gains. And what we found, I'm going to tell you about the curriculum in just a second, but just to give you the preview on the results, is that the most important negotiations for these girls were with their parents for tuition fees, for their grade 9 test scores, exams, and time to be able to study instead of doing chores or taking care of their siblings. And so the girls that are given negotiation training are much more likely to stay in school throughout grades 9 to 11, and it is like a 14% increase on the probability of reaching grade 11. And what's really interesting is it doesn't fade out the way some interventions do. It gets bigger and bigger over time. And I think part of that is that it's a skill you learn. And in fact, the girls had started learning it with their siblings. Like, hey, could you take care of this while I take care of this? That kind of intertemporal trades that you can make. And then they start with more and more high stakes negotiations. And so the skill improved, but then also potentially it put them on a different track as they started early on. And in fact, it allowed them to go into these higher quality schools. That means they would go into more science areas, for example. Now, these young women that were trained in grade 8 are now in their early 20s. And so what we'd like to do is to evaluate the long-term outcomes, medium-run outcomes of the negotiation training, so that we could look at both within the household and especially in the labor market, given what I just shared with you, does this then allow them to go into male-dominated sectors, for example? What does it mean about their first job and their wages in their first job, et cetera? So let me just quickly share with you what the curriculum, in the end, that process of adaptation, what it involved. And what we did was say, look, sometimes you will need to walk away, and you have to think about what your walkaway value is. That could be when you are, for example, wanting to go to the market and buy something, and the person says to you, yes, you could buy this, but I need to have a trade in between, and I would like you to go out on a date with me, for example, and you have no interest in going out on a date with this older man. That's when you walk away. So there's no negotiation to be had there. You just walk away. But with some people, like, for example, with a boyfriend or with your parents, you may want to have a longer-term relationship. So how do you then decide if you're going to stay there? What do you want to do? So the first step is me. And that means you have to decide not only what your position is, but what your interests are. And that's very hard to do. You have to really know what you really want in your heart. And so let's take an example, which is what a lot of girls faced, which is that they wanted to be able to stay in school and have time to study, but their mom needed them to take care of their siblings and the chores in the house while she went to the marketplace to work. And so, okay, your position is you would like to go to school and be able to do the studying that you need for your exams. What are the interests underneath your positions? They are to be able to get good schooling, to be able to make a lot of money when you go out, to be able to return that money to your family, to be able to marry someone who also is educated. And in Zambia, there is a bride price, which increases with education, which is a wonderful part of the market potentially. And so we also say, look, and that can actually give an incentive to parents to educate girls. And then those are your interests. Now we have to take the perspective of your mother. And the problem on the you side in adaptation was that in any other curriculum in negotiation, when you teach it, you just ask directly, why do you want what you want? In Zambia, if you do that, it's very rude, especially if you're a young girl. So you can't do that. So we say step to their side. And that's why you see find the good, choose the approach, discover their interests. Again, remember, what we're trying to do is build the social fabric, enhance the social fabric, while each person asks for what they want. And so finding the good is your mom actually is thinking about you as well. So she's actually trying to make money for the whole family to have food, and she's trying to take care of all your siblings, and she also cares about you going to school and maybe being able to help the family later on. She wants you to get a good bride price. These are all like, and these are your common interests too, so you can think about where they at last. Now there's going to be some that are not the same, and that's where you have to be creative. And so the creative solutions part was really about finding these really high value intertemporal trades. So what is low cost for you, high value for the other person? So for example, there were cases where, and actually we'll see this, is that girls would do all of their chores on the weekends. So in fact, we find that girls do, parents report girls doing more chores than they were doing before, they're just doing them on the weekends. Or they would go off and be able to sell other things in the marketplace during their breaks and be able to. And then what we do is in order to, because we were so concerned in particular about backlash effects of girls asking for what they want, in the middle, before we even looked at the sort of effects on the educational outcomes, we brought all the parents and the girls together to play trust games in the school with their guardians. And in the trust games, we looked at the girls who had been taught negotiation skills, and we added a communication condition. Now, as you probably know, in the literature on trust and trust games, if you add communication, that's considered cheap talk, right? Because how are you gonna really be able to tell me that you're gonna be able to send money back? And so what we thought we'd see is, okay, if the girls were getting backlash in their families, where, you know, she'd become kind of a girl who was just asking for what she wanted all the time, then in this trust game, and if she was able to communicate, in fact, there would be a little bit of backlash and the mother wouldn't give her what she needed. Okay, so what had happened in this case was that the guardian was given the tokens and the girl in the communication condition could ask the mother to send her some and to say that she would send some back. And what you see is here's the efficiency frontier, just like I showed you in the theoretical one. This is the real one using the actual token sent and returned for girls and their guardians. And you see that in the negotiation treatment, when given the opportunity to communicate, the girls had learned how to be able to engender the trust, and they got closer to the frontier in the case with communication. What's really interesting about these graphs is not only did they get closer to the frontier, but they also got more for themselves. So getting closer to the frontier did not come at the risk of getting less for themselves. In fact, they were able to do both. And, you know, it allowed households to find less costly ways. They really did find these joint gains. And this didn't come at the expense of other siblings, for example. Also, parents report that girls are more likely to be respectful and less likely to be rude. And that has to do with the thing that we said about choosing their approach. So as one girl said, you know, she put on her tutenge, which is a marker of respect, knelt before them, and she chose her approach with respect. And she said she really wanted to go back to school. They knew. And so that's how they decided to sell chickens in the market over the school holiday. And she could use the money for her school fees. And again, that's little bits of trust that built up over time to create this kind of trade that allowed both sides to have their interests met. And so as I mentioned, our hope is to be able to look at now, as these girls are entering their adulthood, what happens in sort of all the other areas of their life, and in particular with labor market and entrepreneurship. So basically it's all in Lusaka, so we can link it with the markets that are involved and be able to see that. Because as you see, then it'll help us to see what is the importance of bargaining power for getting to the frontier and where you get on the frontier, and what's the importance of institutions. And we can have a condition where we see both and look at, you know, do both together give us infinitely more? Not infinitely, but some degree of calibration more. So just to step back in terms of what we're learning, that vulnerability to expropriation overall may limit market exchanges, as well as creative or entrepreneurial partnerships. And you can think of probably many other applications. In Lusaka, we find substantial gender gaps in trust and business collaboration. What proximity to a local institution mitigates this trust, and to look for more causal evidence, we do an adapted trust game, investment game, where access to an unbiased local ruler significantly increases women's trusting behavior. And that, in turn, increases the joint surplus that both partners are able to receive, increasing economic gains for the market overall. So improving institutions, this gives you kind of evidence at a very micro level. While we have a lot of macro evidence on the importance of institutions, this is really micro level evidence that improving institutions can particularly allow groups that have weak power, who fear exploitation, to reap the benefits of urban trade and real full participation in economic markets. And that could lead to productive entrepreneurial growth and gains for all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.